dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bass to the playhouse of fortune to take the bride's silver.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. My name's Lynn Gary. If the war on drugs was meant to eliminate drugs, it has failed miserably. More than $1 trillion of taxpayers' money has been spent and continues to be spent in its name. It has, however, succeeded admirably in achieving certain results. The police have been transformed into a militarized occupying army that shoots citizens with impunity. Millions of dollars worth of citizens' property has been seized under asset forfeiture laws. Our rights of privacy and freedom from search and seizure have been shredded, and in the name of the so-called drug war, millions of citizens have been deprived of their liberty, their lives and families destroyed. The drug war has resulted in the doubling of the prison population and the development of prisons as a profitable industry. Profitable for some, that is. It has degraded our people to the point where they no longer find it outrageous that an employer may demand they pee in a bottle. And it has provided cover for the use of the U.S. military to repress the populations of foreign nations who are attempting to free themselves from the domination of U.S.-based transnational corporations. The war on drugs has caused more damage than drugs ever have or could. Tonight, we're first going to hear about the policy implications of the drug war and the role played by the CIA. Bruderhof Radio interviewed former DEA undercover agent Mike Levine, who is now devoting his life to exposing how fraudulent the drug war is. Then, we'll hear a panel which took place in Ithaca last May on reforming New York's Rockefeller drug laws and how these have ruined the lives of tens of thousands of New Yorkers. There's one other thing to consider. In spite of the praises of capitalism sung by government and business, the fact is that capitalism, left to its own devices, produces a society with a few powerful monopolies and a large impoverished population, as is the case in the Third World. It also produces repeated depressions. Though it's not going to be said on the nightly news, the policy elite is all too aware that it was the Second World War that really ended the depression because of the massive government spending that war entails. To prop up the house of cards that is Wall Street, our nation must be continually at war with something. You are constantly treated to a parade of manufactured crises to keep you handing over your money and your freedom to the state. If you are one of my neighbors with the stars and stripes on a flagpole who votes Republican because you think that they're against big government, please pay very close attention. You're right about one thing, though. Protect that Second Amendment. It stands between you and fascism. And it's under serious assault by people who would know better if we had a real free press in this country.
Welcome to Bruderhof Radio, an independent production broadening the bounds of discourse on progressive thought and action.
We're using war on drugs as a pretext to feed weapons for political purposes to crush what Central Intelligence perceives as the opposition to the American way, when in fact we're supporting the destroyers of the American life. I think probably the biggest danger to America and our democracy at this point in our history is the CIA itself.
This week on Bruderhof Radio, an interview with former federal agent Mike Levine. Levine served with the Drug Enforcement Agency for 17 years, until 1990. During the 1980s, the Drug Enforcement Agency acknowledged Levine as one of their best agents. But despite his years of witnessing and taking part in the drug war, Levine now spends his time telling people about its failures. Early in his career as a federal agent, Levine began to see how politicians and bureaucrats lied to the American people and taxed them billions of dollars to fight a losing battle. Calling it the highest kind of treason imaginable committed by a government against its own people, he eventually decided that he had to expose the fraud inherent in the drug war. One thing I'm interested in, and hopefully in the show we can get to some specific examples a little later, but I'm interested in the role of the CIA and other agencies such as the DEA and the ATF in the forming of United States policy, both domestic and foreign. It seems to me that almost every major problem, or what I would see as a problem in this century, came from some sort of government or CIA bungling. I mean, we can think of the Bay of Pigs and almost every country in Central America. What's your take on that?
Well, I wrote an article called Spies Who Shagged Us, you know, kind of tongue-in-cheek, but based on fact, you know, comparing Central Intelligence and other covert agencies to Austin Powers. It's only a miracle that they haven't gotten us into a nuclear war. And this isn't just my judgment. This is the judgment of people hired by Central Intelligence, whom I allude to, whom I quote in the article, who said that they are inept, that they are the tail that wags the dog, that they should be revamped, redone, and our government, our elected protectors, instead of, you know, tearing them apart and rebuilding them so that they serve the American people instead of themselves, and dangerously so, has just given them more money with every problem. And I list all the problems, like you know, Alder James, their counterintelligence expert from who was alleged to fight the Russians for 8 years, the head of that effort, and he in actuality was working for the KGB in all that time. And you know, their failure to recognize the fall of communism in Russia, which is, you know, kind of bizarre, and them bombing the Chinese embassy, you know, after they looked the other way while the Chinese got all our nuclear secrets, which is probably one of the dumbest moves ever done by any intelligence agency in history. You know, it's just so awful. Their own judgment about the Bay of Pigs and Vietnam, wherein it was their lies, they lied to the president, their ineptitude, their ego, their belief that they were Austin Powers, that almost brought us into nuclear conflagrations several times already. And I think probably the biggest danger to America and our democracy at this point in our history is the CIA itself, and I am a qualified expert.
Mike, it's clear from your long history of service, I guess we would call it, for this variety of secret agencies, that what you've mentioned, the sort of the ego that goes on in there, could you describe that a bit? It seems that maybe everyone who works for these agencies gets the feeling that they're invincible, that they're outside of the law. Is that maybe what propagates these large mistakes?
Sure. You know, my sense of it is, and I've seen it, is that each of them, you know, each of Central Intelligence people, for instance, and a lot of federal agents are given a badge and the credentials, and they somehow believe themselves to have ascended to some sort of godlike status. In fact, I based the book Triangle of Death on a real conversation that I took part in Buenos Aires, Argentina, in 1979, wherein a CIA officer said that, you know, to Argentine secret police, who were then busily killing off anyone who was anti-government, that America should be more like Argentina. And as I detailed in Triangle of Death, he then proceeded to show how it could be done in America, that by creating by a scare, for instance, he said, you know, a terrible drug, America would ask for their constitutional rights to be taken away. And that actually happened during the Bush administration, when crack was first recognized as the scourge that it is, and all of that stuff that the media is telling us. The American people showed in a poll that 60% of us wanted, would be willing to give up constitutional rights to win a drug war that really doesn't even exist. And Central Intelligence actually took that as a mandate. And, of course, when we wrote Triangle of Death, the first thing that happened was, mysteriously, an ISBN number, which is the Social Security number, more or less, of a book, a false one appeared in every computer in the country, which acted like an invisible Pac-Man. If you ordered the book, it would go into the computer and never be delivered. And it took us 10 months to realize that they had actually destroyed the distribution of the book. And if anyone thinks I'm not telling the truth, if you can get hold of a soft cover version of Triangle of Death and take it into any library and compare it to this huge volume called Books in Print, and you will see that Triangle of Death is the only book that has a different ISBN number in the book than the one listed in Books in Print. Now that you can't argue with.
Mike, have you been targeted in any other ways by government agencies because of your outspokenness?
Well, it's very difficult for them to target me other than physically, which I don't think they will do because so many Americans, it's a strange paradox. You know, Americans believe that if I'm telling the truth, I should be dead, which probably keeps me alive. You know, why kill me? As far as my credibility goes, well, the Justice Department in a New York Times article, June 16th, 1986, called Acting on a Deadly Stage, called me one of their best. Now, and then they, a British writer wrote a book about me while I was still a DEA agent called Undercover by Donald Goddard. And he quotes DEA and government officials again as calling me one of the best. So how do you take that back now? Their best technique now is to ignore that I exist. You know, you don't want to call me before Congress because I'm too credible. And they're doing it quite successfully. In fact, so successfully that when I wrote Deep Cover, it was voted by California University and then presented by Bill Moyers on a national TV show as one of the 10 most censored stories in America.
Mike, we've been talking a little bit about the drug war here already, and that is one of the examples of CIA foreign intervention that I'd like to get into in more detail here. Could you just update us on the current situation in Colombia and the so-called drug war?
We're in there basically under the pretext of fighting a drug war against, and the media is constantly coining this phrase, these narco-terrorists and narco-guerrillas, when in fact, again, I could testify to this in court using specifics, we're supporting the real narco-terrorists and the real narco-guerrillas. And I don't know what more I can say. It's just a continued fraud. It's similar to Vietnam in that we now know that if you listen to mainstream media during the buildup of Vietnam and you just read New York Times headlines and articles where they just, you know, rubber-stamped everything the government said, well, we should have won. But the fact is, it was only small media outlets like yours and myself that were telling the truth. Well, the same thing is happening now. We're telling you the truth. We're telling you that American boys are going to die. Billions of American dollars are going to be spent. We can't win when we're supporting people who are already, you know, aiding and abetting the destruction of American youth.
Mike, it's interesting that you compare to Vietnam because that's one thing that we don't see in the mainstream media. They're often quick to point out that this is not a Vietnam, that U.S. troops are not going to be involved, but isn't this what they said at the beginning of Vietnam when they sent the so-called non-combatant advisors over in the 1950s? They very quickly became the combat troops of the 1960s. Is this going to happen in Colombia?
Oh, yeah. Well, not only that. You know, the thing about it is it isn't me that is the first to compare it to Vietnam. The first people to compare it to Vietnam were two Republican senators about 2 weeks ago. And, of course, that never got into mainstream media. It was on, I picked it up off the Internet, but on the floor of Congress, two Republican senators said precisely the current Clinton administration policy in Vietnam reminds them of is the buildup of Vietnam, and they called it the debacle of Vietnam. And so it's not just me. I mean, you have a case where, mainstream media is kowtowing to the power, whoever's in the White House. Their main aim in life is to sell media, that is to sell newspapers, to get media ratings points, and to do that they have to have access to the people who are in power at the time, and to get that access they have to be friendly. So the policy is, no matter how stupid the policy might be, the policy right now is that, we're fighting drugs. And most Americans, if it's not in the New York Times, simply don't believe it's true. And that's very unfortunate, and that is Vietnam being revisited.
Now, caught up in the whole so-called drug war is, in fact, a civil war in Colombia. How much are these things related, and how much are U.S. weapons that are, I guess, earmarked for the drug war, how much are they just being used by the Colombian government to squash the FARC, the main insurgent group in Colombia?
Well, all of it. And the policy is so incredibly stupid. You know, that one of the shows that I did on the expert witness was us giving military weapons, now get this, to the Chinese nationalists. These are the people who gave us Tiananmen Square under the banner of us helping them in the international drug war, you know, to police their borders with drug-dealing countries. Now, everyone involved knows that that's an absolute lie. I mean, we even gave them Humvees, you know, and I wrote an article, I called it Humvees for the Chinese, and it never in mainstream media did anybody point out that, well, what are we going to do if the Chinese invade Burma as part of a drug war invasion, the way we invaded Panama? You know, it's so incredibly short-sighted and Austin Powerish and dumb. And then you have mainstream media talking heads. You know, they kind of remind me of like the dogs on car dashboards with the heads going up and down, you know, like Ted Koppel saying, well, of course, you know, the government wouldn't lie, and they probably, unbelievable. So most Americans believe that. And as I wrote in The Big White Lie, when Central Intelligence was supporting the right wing in Bolivia, the Bolivian Revolution in 1980, what they were really supporting was the takeover of Bolivia, then the source of virtually all the cocaine on the face of the earth, by drug dealers, you know, who were quote-unquote right-wingers. And they were doing it for political reasons. They said that this is anti-communism. Well, you know, the fact is that the drug dealers were a lot smarter than the CIA. They want to sell drugs, so they'll be anti-communist, whatever it takes to get CIA support and backing. Manuel Noriega did it for 20 years, including having lunch with Bush himself. And it's a continuation of the same policy in South America, and that is that we support the right wing against the left wing. And I'm not politically motivated in any way. I'm not a Republican. You know, I'll vote for anybody who runs for office who says I'm for the American people. You know, I'm not for any of this two-party system, which has brought us, you know, presidents who lie right in our faces, from Bush and Reagan to Clinton. You know, Bush, I didn't know Manuel Noriega was a drug dealer. Reagan, I didn't trade guns for hostages. And Clinton, I didn't have sex with that woman. Then the media, decries anyone who doesn't trust the government. Well, you know, the same thing is happening in Colombia right now. It's just more of an incredible continuity of lies to the American people. We're using war on drugs as a pretext to feed weapons for political purposes, to crush what Central Intelligence perceives as the opposition to the American way, when in fact we're supporting the destroyers of the American life.
You're listening to former Drug Enforcement Agency operative Michael Levine on Bruderhof Radio. To learn more about today's program, call us at 1-800-778-8461. Are we going to see in a few years some sort of a Pentagon Papers history of the U.S. drug war come out, or did the government learn their lesson not to keep such detailed histories of what they're doing?
Yeah, they've learned. You know, instead of the government getting any better, what they got better at is stomping on so-called whistleblowers, destroying the careers of anybody who comes out to try to defend the American people. This is the paradox that goes on right now, and the paradox is the following. And it's a continuation throughout my career. I took two oaths, one to defend the secrets of a bureaucracy and the other to defend the Constitution and the American people. immediately all of us who get in a position where we see top-level secret events transpiring, we realize that we can't keep both oaths, that what we're witnessing is the absolute destruction of the Constitution, the absolute endangering of the American people and our way of life. Now, to tell that, we have to violate the other oath. So anybody who's inside has to worry about the destruction of his career by adhering to the oath to defend the American people. Almost everybody who's come out has been destroyed or had to suffer attempts at destruction. And then what they find is they're ignored by media. There's nobody there to stand up for you. There is no American public to stand up for you. The media is thoroughly, and Central Intelligence brags about this in in-house memos, thoroughly controlled by our covert agencies, and you're out there alone. So people wonder why, you know, nobody stands up. And because, as one writer once said, the odds, you have better odds playing Russian roulette than you do becoming a whistleblower in the United States government.
What is the actual extent of the drug war, the physical amount of money and goods that the United States is sending down there? I just saw an item in the paper the other day, I think it was September 1st, that 6 more anti-drug helicopters were hand-delivered to Colombia by 2 United States congressmen. Does that sort of thing happen every week?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, yeah, just take a quick count. It cost us $250 million to get Manuel Noriega, who we were supporting. $250 million. And as many as 1,000 lives, including 26 American soldiers, while Manuel Noriega was on the CIA payroll, and everyone knew he was a drug dealer. And immediately thereafter, the drug war was, the drug trafficking condition of Panama had worsened substantially after that. Now, it's easy to say that we have spent during the life of the drug war at this point $1 trillion. Untold numbers of people have died. And all you have to do, without even getting into specifics like that, is look at this massive expenditure, this incredibly long war that is without end. Look on any street corner in America, and it's only worse.
And what is the role of Barry McCaffrey, the so-called drug czar? He just recently went on a tour, I guess you would call it, of Latin America, visited a lot of different countries down in Latin America. What exactly is the drug czar supposed to do?
Yeah, he's the cheerleader for the administration, you know. He mouths all the platitudes. He doesn't qualify in any witness stand in any court in the United States as a drug expert, as none of the drug czars have. He mouths all the platitudes about stopping drugs, even though everyone who studies it knows that it's completely false, and you know, the whole philosophy doesn't work. He's the head talking head, you know. He's the drug war cheerleader, or the equivalent of the March of Dimes poster boy for the drug war. But he serves no other purpose. He has no authority. There's nothing he can do. He's there mainly to convince you, me, and the rest of America that this is the equivalent of the Holy Grail, this war on drugs. And they do a pretty good job of it.
Speaking of cheerleaders, could you comment a little bit on the so-called Partnership for a Drug-Free America? Most people remember them as the people who produced the famous This Is Your Brain on Drug ads with the fried eggs and everything. What's with those ads? Who pays for them, and how effective are they?
Recently, Clinton and Gingrich, you know, raising their mutual hands in quote-unquote victory, gave $2 billion to the Partnership of Drug-Free America. For them to distribute to mainstream media for these ads. And $2 billion, that made them the biggest advertisers on Madison Avenue, double of General Motors. And the trouble with that is that all research has shown these ads not only don't work, they're counterproductive. They introduce the thought of drugs to youth who haven't really even thought about it. At the very best, they can show no efficacy whatsoever. Now, a frustrated DEA agent called me on the QT because, you know, I'm just cheaper than a psychiatrist and they know I won't blow their cover, and said, Mike, that $2 billion could have bought every coca leaf from every farmer in South America. And instead, the first 60 million was going to people like Disney. I mean, you can see those ads, you know, those kind of ridiculous ads in movies and newspapers. And it's really just the transference of this enormous amount of money to mainstream media. So what happens is, the bottom line of it is, who in mainstream media is going to contest it? Who in mainstream media is going to say anything but that this is the most effective thing to do, when it's an absolute lie? It's kind of mafia-like against the American people. In fact, USA Today, 2 weeks ago, headlined a statistic there's a downturn in the use of drugs, you know, and yeah, called it turning the corner in the drug war. Now, the subtext is, well, the $2 billion is well spent. But, it's such an obvious lie. All they have to do is look back in their own archives, and they'll see that Drugs Czar Bennett 8 years ago had retired in victory for the same exact statistic. You know, it's a statistic that's repeated throughout the history of the drug war. It goes up and down, you know. So they wait for a downturn, any downturn, and they claim victory. But, again, the subtext is that, wow, this $2 billion is well spent, when in actuality, it's a mafia-type robbery with a license. Let me repeat that the Partnership for Drug-Free America, their ads are counterproductive. That is, there's strong evidence that they do exactly the reverse of what they're intended to do. That is, they introduce the thought, they advertise the use of drugs. Although, you know, clearly they claim that they're telling people not to use drugs. But you can't have sports figures, for instance, who everyone knows are doing public service ads between trips to the Betty Ford Clinic and being on parole. And, you know, kids laugh at this stuff. You have to understand that the Partnership for a Drug-Free America now has many people already on retirement. And that if you're an employee of the partnership, you're a new employee, you're not really seriously thinking about ending a drug war. You're thinking about medical benefits that most of America doesn't have, and retirement. It's a wonderful job. You really want to win a drug war? I think the evidence shows absolutely not. And I guess you can sum it all up by saying that most of the people who wear the white hats in the war on drugs are really not the good guys at all. They make a living off the drug war, just the way the drug dealers do.
I noticed on the news the other day that I think 15 more airline workers in Miami airport were...
That's a Xerox pro forma drug story. You know how many arrests like that I've done over the years? Here's the thing about that. Every time the media has called me recently, there's been revelations that Mexico is a bigger threat again, you know, to America, corrupt Mexican government. And so my question to this particular media guy was, well, hold on. How come we voted Mexico a cooperating nation then? You know, could it have anything to do with NAFTA? The media guy's eyes roll up in his head. And he said, well, what about this case, this particular case? And I said, well, this case, if you look back in your own archives, is exactly the same kind of case that your newspaper has printed almost bi-monthly over the last 30 years. All you have to do is change the names, change the dates, change the amounts, but the syntax, the sentence structure, everything is precisely the same. You don't need a comment. You need a Xerox machine. And the danger of what you're doing, and this applies to this airline case, is you're selling the drug war. You're telling America that this war is somehow real. So this airline case, I've taken part in dozens of them, precisely the same over the last 30 years. It's no difference, just the names are different. Means nothing. And you'll see more, you know, but I guess the public retention is so short that you think it's a new story. It's precise. And I found, and I documented, going back 80 years, the same identical story. 80 years, long before war on drugs was declared by President Nixon. It sells newspapers, you know, these headlines, but it also sells a completely fraudulent war on drugs. The big mistake media makes is, like court reporters, they go after each new drug war story as if there's nothing, you know, it's brand new. The history is, you know, doesn't even exist anymore. It's, you know, for instance, this USA Today claiming these new statistics as being indicative of we turned the corner in the war on drugs, in spite of the fact that, as I pointed out in my book, turning the corner on the war on drugs is the biggest inside joke in DEA, where they say, I guess we've squared the block again, you know, that's been going on and on. But yet it's headlines in America. And that's unfortunate.
That's all for this edition of Bruderhof Radio, a discussion with former DEA agent Mike Levine. For more information about the topics in today's program, you can call Mike Levine at 212-209-2870.
The program you just heard was produced by Andrew Zimmerman for Bruderhof Radio. The interview with Mike Levine took place a year ago, so Plan Columbia was not specifically discussed. However, it makes it pretty clear what's going on there. If you'd like more information on Bruderhof Radio and the Bruderhof community, visit their website at www.bruderhof.org.
This forum has been organized by the Tompkins County Interfaith Campaign to Reform the Rockefeller Drug Laws. There's been really a great amount of interfaith activity going on around this issue throughout the state. The New York State Community of Churches, the New York State Catholic Conference, and the Board of Rabbis have all been working together to promote a more just and humane alternative to our present system of dealing with the drug problem in New York State. So what we're doing here on a local level is being mirrored in many other places across the state. At this time, I'll hand things over to Reverend Doug Green, who is our moderator for the program tonight.
There'll be no sermon, so don't worry. We're just going to... I almost feel like we should have a prayer, though, this being an interfaith group and gathering. And for me, I'm just going to say that I think the attempt to use legal means and prisons to deal with addiction and problems like that, when it is clearly a life issue and a spiritual issue that encompasses one's whole life, I think is a travesty. And the Rockefeller laws are just some of the worst laws that I've ever seen, and it's been a real eye-opener. I want to thank Edie Regan and Catholic Charities for bringing some of the Protestant pastors like myself together with them, along with the rabbis, so that we could begin to get some feeling as to what's been happening in the state. Let me just tell you what we hope to do tonight is we have three very good speakers who have some really fascinating information and kind of disturbing information in some places that they want to share with us. We're going to start with Terry Derrickart, and she's going to talk a little bit about the Rockefeller laws, and I'll come right back to that in a sec. Then Elaine Bartlett is going to share her story that if you saw the news tonight, you probably caught a little bit of it on Channel 7, but she'll be sharing her story and what her life was like. And then Marty Luster, our assemblyman, who... it has introduced a bill to reform the Rockefeller laws. Will give us some information on that and tell us a few things that we can do. After we have the speakers make their presentations, we'd like to have time for question and answers. And there are a lot of people here, so we would just hope that we can spend a little time doing that. And before you leave, there are some tables out in the back that have the three tables with a lot of information in all these three different areas that the various speakers represent. And I just hope you'd take a chance to stop by and pick up some of the information out there. Terry Derrickart is the director of the New York State Chapter of Families Against Mandatory Minimums. It's a national nonprofit organization. It has, I believe, around 35,000 members nationally, 2,000 members here in the state of New York. She, before this, worked teaching through in the prison system here in the state, and we're real pleased that she could be here tonight to share some information with us.
I'd like to start off with a joke. It always loosens everybody up. This man went before a judge because he had been convicted of killing an osprey. And before sentencing, the judge said, "Do you have anything to say for yourself?" And he says, "Well, yes, Your Honor." He said, "I'm here before you not only because I killed a bird that was on an endangered species list, but I just got to tell you one thing." He said, "You know, I've been out of work, my wife's on disability, I've got five children at home to feed, And he was giving him this whole spiel, his whole life story, his whole tale of sad woes, in hopes that the judge could take that into consideration when he was about to sentence him. And so the judge says, well, given this, you know, set of circumstances, I'll just sentence you to 2 hours of community service and you can go on your way. And on his way out the door, the judge says, excuse me, sir, I just have one question for you. And the man turned around and he says, exactly what does Osprey taste like? He says, a lot like Bald Eagle. But I guess the point of that story is, you know, in that particular case, you know, somebody is convicted of a crime, they come before a judge, and prior to sentencing, the judge can take into account all the circumstances and nature of the crime. But under the Rockefeller drug laws, that is not the case. The Rockefeller drug laws, or mandatory minimum sentences, are based on two things: the type of drug and the weight of the drug. Forget about who you are, whether or not you've had any priors, whether or not you're addicted, or whether or not you're economically disadvantaged, whether or not you were just in the house at the time when a drug sale was going on unbeknownst to you. None of that matters at sentencing time, because all it really comes into play is what drug and what's the weight. And sometimes as little quantity as like a half a gram can determine a 15-year sentence versus a 10-year sentence. So Families Against Mandatory Minimums, like our introduction, is a national organization. We have federal mandatory minimums that you should all be aware of, and we also have one of the harshest state laws in the country. And that's why FAM is working really hard in New York State to try to appeal to groups around the state and hopefully appeal to our legislators to show them the need for bringing our justice system back to where our forefounders had it. We used to have an individualized system of justice, but with mandatory minimums, it seems that our lawmakers in Albany or our lawmakers in Washington are deciding sentences for people they've never met. And what's wrong with that picture? What's wrong with that picture is that it sort of dehumanizes the person. You're all of a sudden a number in the system. With the Rockefeller drug laws, for those of you that aren't familiar with it, let me just say a few words about what they actually are. There are two parts to the Rockefeller drug laws. One is the felony classes for first-time offenders, and then we have another set of laws called the second felony law. With the first-time felony offenders, the felony classes run from an A felony down to an E felony. And the harshest sentence are our A1 felonies, where a possession of 4 ounces or more, or a sale of 2 ounces or more, will give you anywhere from 15 to 25 years mandatory minimum with life as a maximum. A2 felonies, if you're just a half of an ounce short of the 4 ounces, all of a sudden you would get 3 years to life under an A2 felony. B felonies, one half ounce to 2 ounces possession, less than a half ounce sale, gives you anywhere from 1 to 25 years in prison. Our marijuana laws have changed since Rockefeller drug laws were instituted, and most of them are in the misdemeanor class. What's wrong with the mandatory minimum sentences? Well, the first thing I mentioned is that they severely limit a judge's ability to fit the punishment to the crime and to the offender. FAM has never said that crime should go unpunished, but that the punishment should fit the crime. And it's my belief that we should have a graduated system of sanctions. I'm a parent, many of you out there are parents, and I was talking to a group of parents at a school function the other day, and I said, you know, a mandatory minimum sentence, if we were to translate that into parenting, it would be like grounding your teenager for 1 year for coming home late from school one time. You know, I think in parenting, in education, even in the military, as our drug czar Barry McCaffrey told me last June when I met him, he said the graduated system of sanctions works in the military, it works in education, it works in parenting. It should be applied to criminal justice. So an expensive state prison bed is not the first order of sanction, I believe, in a drug offense. I think we should have a graduated system of sanctions. The other problem with mandatory sentencing is that it's shifting the power away from the judge to the prosecutor. Most of the drug cases are usually handled behind closed doors, out of view of the public, between the defendant, the prosecutor, and the public defense. When a prosecutor gives a sentence to someone, giving them a felony class, they're in effect deciding their sentence. So really, the judge is almost like a clerk, if you will, kind of cookie cutter, just sending people through the system. We feel that it's undermining the authority of the judicial system, and that's why, I don't know if you realize this or not, but that's why our Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, William Rehnquist, on down, have taken public stands against mandatory minimum sentencing. Judges do not like that. They don't like their authority being usurped by the prosecution. The other problem is that they result in disproportionately harsh sentences for low-level couriers and addicts. Very often, the drug kingpins who are running the whole drug trade in our country, they're smart enough to know that they're never going to carry drugs on them, and so they hire people further down the line or further down the food chain, as we call it. And so the people who really should be in prison for bringing in thousands and thousands of pounds of drugs into this country are rarely caught, rarely prosecuted. Who's caught? The person at the lowest level, the person who might have been handed a package, the person who might have drugs on them because they're addicted. And I feel really strongly, because addiction has touched my family in a very profound way, that we as a society cannot continue to incarcerate people with a medical problem. I think that's morally wrong. Like our introduction said, it's morally wrong, and I really am excited to see so many groups coming together on this issue to say that addicts are not bad people trying to get good, but sick people trying to become well. And very many cases that we've seen come through our office on the Rockefeller drug laws are people who have addictions, people who didn't ask to be addicts, but nevertheless have the disease of addiction. And so what are we prepared to do for them? The last thing that I want to mention is that the Rockefeller drug laws have a disproportionate impact on minorities. An FBI report came out last year that said most of the drug use in America is really among the Caucasian group of people. Yet 90% of those imprisoned across the country for drug offenses are Black and Latino. It's really too bad that if you are European or Caucasian and you have an addiction, you are treated as a person who has a health problem. Yet if you are another color, you are treated in the criminal justice system. There's something inherently wrong with that. And FAM is working diligently to try to correct that. And I'm sure Marty Lester will talk a little bit more about his bill and about the whole drug court movement that's springing up throughout New York State. Last but not least, there's a lot of things that we talk about when it comes to Rockefeller drug laws. We talk about that prior to the Rockefeller drug laws we had. Does anybody want to guess how many prisoners we had in our whole state prior to the Rockefeller drug laws? 12,500. Okay, anybody venture to guess how many prisoners we have in our state system right now?
70,000.
Very good, you guys have been studying. And the number's going up. We have 130% capacity. Our prisons, our state prisons alone are at 130% capacity. Most of the state-ready inmates are being backed up in your county jails. Your county jails are getting bigger and bigger, and you're going to start having to pass bonds to build bigger jails to house these people unless we come up with a creative solution. And this creative solution is community sentencing, alternatives to incarceration, treatment on demand for people who are addicted. One of the figures we like to throw around is that it costs approximately $32,000 a year to incarcerate one person for 1 year in a state prison. It only costs around $6,000 for outpatient drug and alcohol treatment. We might be talking 12 or 13,000 if we put someone in a residential program. So not only does it have humane advantages to changing laws, but we see tremendous cost-saving advantages. Back there on our FAM table, you'll see a chart that I put together on the cost effectiveness of alternatives to incarceration. That's something we really should be looking at as a community and having you urge your lawmakers to go in that direction. One thing that I'd like to mention too is because FAM stands for Families Against Mandatory Minimums, I can't talk about this law without talking about the effects on the family. Every week I get hundreds of letters from families across the state that are begging us to work harder to change these laws because their moms are in prison or their dads are in prison. We had to testify last year, and we're going to have another hearing this year in New York City on the effects of incarceration on children and families. And I'm excited to see that the debate is going beyond criminal justice and beyond drug and alcohol treatment, and it's getting out there into the family unit. Pope John Paul II had a wonderful quote. He said in one of his speeches that any law that afflicts the family cannot be good for society, because the family is the building block of society. In any nation, any civilization that passes laws that tear down the family unit eventually finds out the hard way that the way that they're doing things is not the right way. And so as a FAM person, I can't say enough about the effects of long-term incarceration on families, and especially on our children. One of the biggest indicators of whether or not someone is going into the criminal justice system is whether or not they've had a parent incarcerated and whether or not there's addiction in their family. So we have to stop this cycle of reincarceration by looking at these laws and finding creative solutions. I believe we have the solutions. I really do. We've had enough studies. There's been a tremendous number of studies on the effectiveness of drug treatment versus long-term incarceration. There's been studies on the effects of family. There's effects of community sentencing and pulling the family unit back together so they could all heal as a unit. But I think what's needed today is the political will to do something about it. And I'm just ecstatic to be on the same panel with Marty Lester, because he's one of the people. I came down from Albany tonight for this talk, and I'll tell you, from walking the halls in the legislative office building in the Capitol, there are so few people who really have the courage to do what's right. And you should be blessed here in Ithaca to have Marty as your representative. And I'm not just saying this because he's sitting there. I really believe that. And if he wasn't, he'd hear it from me too, because I'm the pit bull in the skirt in Albany. But so many people that are elected, somehow they forget the message when they get to Albany, or they forget the message when they go to Congress, that they work for us, not the other way around. And so if there's anything you can take from this talk tonight, is that you are the government. We are the government. These guys work for us. We have to tell them what we want, what's close to our heart, what's right, and hold them accountable.
Thanks, Terry. And speaking also of devastating stories, we're real happy tonight to have Elaine Bartlett here. I had the pleasure of breaking bread with Elaine over at Gino Bush's house for dinner, and had a chance to get to know her a little bit and asked her how she'd describe herself. She says, "I'm a survivor of the Rockefeller laws." A mother of four, a grandmother of three. She spent 16 years, 2 weeks, and 3 days in prison, which was outrageous when you hear her story. Absolutely outrageous. So here's someone who can tell us exactly how the Rockefeller laws impact individuals and families. Elaine?
Thank you. And I appreciate y'all having me here tonight to hear my story, to taking the time to come out from your families and your loved ones to hear what I have to say. In 1983, I agreed to travel to Albany and deliver a package to George Dietz, who I thought at the time was a friend and someone that was trying to help me because of my situation that I was a mother for, living in Wagner Projects, paying $127 a month for rent, and struggling with four children. Little did I know that George Dietz used me as a patsy. Him and his two partners in crime had previous records, and to get from under the umbrella of doing time for themselves, they decided that they would use me and give me up as the kingpin. I had $5 in my pocket at the time. I was a first-time offender, never been in trouble with the law a day in my life, not even a parking ticket. I arrived in Albany. I had a jury hearing and was found guilty and sentenced to 20 to life. When the judge told me I sentenced you to 20 to life, I thought I was going to faint in the courtroom. I couldn't believe that the man sentenced me to 20 to life for 4 ounces of cocaine. These are your Rockefeller drug lords, and this is what goes on with families. I was fortunate enough to have a mother who could take my four children and raise them while I was away. How many other families are not that fortunate and their kids have to go into the foster care system? They become abused, they get shipped around from one place to another, they get mistreated and lost in the system. How many people are gonna go out and adopt our children, people of color and Hispanic? The chances are 1 in 1,000,000. What saddens me is that after doing 16 years, 2 weeks, and 3 days, I come back out free, happy to be free, but the same communities, the same drug-infested neighborhoods, and the drugs have not went anywhere. We have a war on drugs, and it's been that way for years. You spend all this money, the taxpayers' money, that is, on the police, picking up everybody in the street. Now they feel they have a license to just shoot people at random because of their color or the environments that they're in. Our schools are failing our children. Our communities are failing our children. Our churches have closed the door on our children in the communities. They're riding around in brand new cars, living in fancy homes, and our children are out there suffering. I say that we need to educate people. People need to come out and speak and remember that the taxpayers is the ones that can help create these laws and take them away. The Rockefeller drug laws have been installed too long. It has destroyed too many families. After being away for 16 years, you come home, you are a complete stranger to your family. I don't care how much they love you. You abandoned them. They have abandonment issues. They love you, but they're angry with you at the same time because of everything that they went through in them 16 years and you wasn't there. You can't get the birthdays back. You can't get the graduations back. You can't get the nights that they laid up crying wanting mommy and she was nowhere to be found. They don't understand that you didn't kill someone. They don't understand that the crime that you committed didn't warrant 20 years out of your life or 16 or 15. It's hard to make kids understand that you broke the law, that I did something wrong, and the judge felt fit to give me 20 years, and I have to be away that long. You can't even begin to explain that to your family. Our families have to alterate their lives, and they become incarcerated with us. They're poor. They don't have the money to travel to the prison system, but they do it. They don't have the money to bring us packages or take care of our needs, our basic hygiene needs and stuff, but they do it. The phone bills are outrageous. So you're constantly just taking more and more from the poor, their families are crumbling, and then loved ones die. They do not live as long as we have the time. We do the time and we come out thinking we're coming back home to our parents, and they're not there. because they couldn't take it no more and they passed away. Families are falling apart. I had a son that went to prison for drugs. I have 3 grandchildren. I'm worried about what their future is going to be. Now, Cuomo is saying that he will not have no jobs for these kids and youth jobs this summer. So where are our children going to be on the streets? What's going to happen to our kids? Are they going to become incarcerated too? Are they going to be victims of the streets and get shot out there? It has to stop. And me being a survivor of the Rockefeller drug laws, if I could prevent any other family from suffering and going through the trials and tribulations that me and my family has went through, then I'll feel that I have accomplished something. I'll feel that all the time that I did being away was worth something, besides them saying they hard on crime and the war on drugs. I was glad that I had the opportunity to educate my family and I was able to come out on clemency. A lot of people are not that fortunate. Clemency is a political game. If we don't have people out here to support us and speak up for us, we're lost. We're cast away. They don't feel that we could rehabilitate ourselves inside. We know that we did something wrong. We're not saying that we didn't. But what we did it warrant the time? 15 years for selling a drug or carrying a drug or delivering a drug to someone or being with someone that has drugs and they get picked up and you get picked up along with them? You can't get them years back. No matter what you do in life, you can never go back and get that back. It becomes a part of your history. I thank God that I was able to educate myself and become the woman I am today. But how many might not be as fortunate as me? How many families might not be able to stick together the way that me and my family was able to stick together? How many more families have to be destroyed? The money that they're using to imprison us for such a long time, why don't they take that money and put it back into our communities? Educate the neighborhoods, educate people, give them training so that they're able to go out and get jobs and come off the street and be productive citizens. The drugs are not going to stop coming into the country because we're not the ones bringing it into the country. But they don't want to talk about that. And every time the Rockefeller drug law bill comes to the floor, it's always swept under the carpet. I ask you not to allow them to sweep it under the carpet again, to make them do something about the Rockefeller drug laws. Thank you.
I'd like to know how we're going to explain it to our children and to the rest of society when things like that can happen. Oh, thank you, Elaine. That was just powerful and good, and you know, we've got some work to do. Speaking of work, our assemblyman, Marty Luster, who's had a very interesting day, if you caught the news a little bit earlier. Marty has been in the assembly for 12 years. He's been an advocate for many issues that are close to all of our hearts. He is, until this morning, was chairman of the Real Property Taxation Committee, and unfortunately isn't anymore because he's leading the fight to try to change the leadership in Albany. And if you're interested in getting the Rockefeller laws reformed, you want to encourage and support him in that battle. And Marty, it's a real pleasure to have you here tonight.
WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.